Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. AmeriHealth Caritas, that's one of the three companies providing care for Iowa's privately managed Medicaid system, will not renew its contracts for next year. And that's creating a headache for a number of Iowans who receive health care through that provider, especially those with complex cases. Beverly Luke is the mother of Caitlin, her daughter, who is disabled and is receiving health care through that insurer right now. She lives in Yale, Iowa, joins me. Beverly Luke, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you for letting us kind of look at the problems that are being created in this privately managed Medicaid system through your case and perhaps some others that you know of. Tell us, first of all, about your daughter. She's in her early 20s?
Yes.
And tell us about her condition.
Okay, Caitlin has a rare genetic disorder, tuberous sclerosis. Everyone has tuberin in their system. It's our natural prohibitor for the growth of tumors, not tumors like malignant tumors, cancer. They're usually benign. They can grow on any vital organ of our body. And she has them on her brain, heart, kidneys, liver. Well, we don't know her liver. That's one of the tests we ran today. Her lungs. She's had embolisms on both kidneys, her right kidney twice, her left kidney once. She had them in her heart when she was born, and as she grew, they did not, so they are not causing issue. In her brain, we watched and monitor them very closely with a neurologist. We started out in Iowa City, and as she grew and moved away from home into a group home, we went through a couple, three neurologists there and decided to move closer to home for a neurologist that was just as knowledgeable as the one in Iowa City. And as she has gotten older, her issues have become more complex as her body has been ravaged by these tumors, and her health has declined.
Mm-hmm.
And we see the doctors more often, and so therefore we count on our health insurance to be there for us and to not have to fight to have bills paid, and she cannot obviously afford to pay these.
Right. So tell us about this latest development, AmeriHealth leaving as an insurer. Where does that leave you, your family? Where does this leave you and Caitlin?
Well, from what I've gotten from her Department of Human Services social worker, caseworker, they just sent us an email and said, I'm sure you've heard the announcement, which, of course, I heard it through social media before anyone contacted me. And they said, they'll choose an insurance for you. Okay. Oh, that's great. Except that we have many, many doctors for Caitlin. We have a nephrologist, a kidney specialist that did the surgery on her kidneys. We have a neurologist. We have a general, family doctor for her. We have a specialist for her lungs. I mean, she has a lot of doctors.
Mm-hmm.
There's no guarantee those doctors that she currently has that know her medical situations now are going to be on whatever insurance they assign us. And they do that because they assign doctors because there's only two MCOs now.
So they have told you that the very complex case that Caitlin has and the numerous doctors that have looked after her who are well acquainted with her specific challenges, they cannot guarantee you that you'll be able to see the same doctors who are the most familiar with this case.
Right. And that was the case when Medicaid was privatized. And of course, I immediately get on the phone and start calling around the MCOs to see, is this doctor, it was left to us to find out, is this doctor going to sign? Well, we don't know. It was in limbo for quite a while. Oh, you can sign up and see your doctors, but we're not going to tell you that doctor will be on your MCO. So it was quite a challenge, and we didn't know. We just chose an MCO and prayed to God they would sign. They did tell us that her dad does carry insurance on her. However, he has high deductible insurance, so nothing's covered, you know, until that deductible is met by the family, which is, you know, $5,000-$10,000, something like that, family-wise, you know. And then he could apply to get her back on the old Medicaid. However, there's some criteria. She has to live at home. She does not. She lives in a group home. She can't have any other insurance. She does. So we're kind of at a loss. They're encouraging us to do that. We don't see the benefit in going through, waiting through all that paperwork to do that when we're almost 100% sure she's going to be denied.
Mm-hmm. Well, so what are you going to do, Beverly?
Right now, they keep encouraging her dad to apply for this old Medicaid. So I guess him and I haven't visited. He's, you know, he works, I work. We thought him and I would sit down and chat tomorrow and find out, is it worth our time to try to do this?
Right.
You know, and how much time is it going to take him out of, you know, we're both busy people. You know, should he do that? Should he not? I'm going to start researching the two other MCOs and see who is currently on those two MCOs as far as, you know, I have to go through the list of the doctors that she has and see who's on there and, you know, who do we lose, you know, and I'm just not really willing to compromise her doctors. I mean, I don't feel that any of them aren't important. They're all important, and what she has is pretty rare. And her neurologist is the top of that because he's kind of he oversees all of it, you know. So
well, okay, sorting that out sounds like a real headache, Beverly.
It is.
To broaden this out a little bit, I understand that you're a paraeducator in the Panorama School District.
Mm-hmm.
So you have contact with a lot of other special needs kids, right? So just in the context of you've had there, talking with parents of other children there, are there similar cases out there? Is yours an isolated case or something that's happened frequently?
Oh, it's frequent. I mean, there's a lot of parents that are concerned with the same thing, you know, and it also affects group homes because these MCOs are delayed in paying the group homes. So then, you know, there's cases of group homes that can't pay their staff, and then their staff quits because they're getting delayed payments from these MCOs.
Right.
So it's not just me. There's a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Are you doing anything at another level? I know you've got to work this out. That's undeniable. But I mean, you contacting your legislators?
Yes, I have been. I've been every time I get the chance, I send another, you know, and I've gotten letters back from David Young, Charles Grassley, you know, emails back from them saying, oh, yes, we're, you know, this is where I received your letter. Thank you for your concern. And, you know, just a general, I got your letter so far. And, you know, that's about all I've gotten so far. And I did write a letter or, you know, send an email to Kim Reynolds and haven't received anything. So.
Okay. Beverly, Luke, thank you for telling us about your daughter's case, your daughter who is disabled, and sorting that out. It sounds like you've got a lot of work ahead of you. We wish you the best in looking after your daughter and fighting for her health care.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll talk about the testimony on Capitol Hill this week, how we learned, well, how Russian trolls got into our Facebook feeds, among other places. We'll talk with Michael Bougie of Iowa State University with his reflections. Also, a wonderful bit of tape. We'll hear Senator Al Franken in a bit of questioning of the general counsel for Facebook, Colin Stretch, an amusing, also, worrying bit of tape there. Mike Hutchison is the general manager of the I-80 truck stop. You know that truck stop. It claims to be the largest truck stop in the world. It's getting even bigger. We'll find out about that a little bit later in the program. But first, former Trump campaign aide Sam Clovis, an Iowan, has pulled his name from consideration as the USDA's top scientist. It comes days after Clovis was linked to the Russia probe, Mueller's investigation. IPR legislative correspondent Joyce Russell joins me now to talk a bit about it. Hi, Joyce.
Hello, Ben.
Before we get to what happened this week, give us some background on Clovis, how he came to be nominated to be the Agriculture Department's chief scientist. I think the official title, the USDA's Undersecretary for Research, Education, and Economics.
Well, he was President Trump's campaign director for the state of Iowa. Then when the president was elected, he was brought on as an advisor in the Trump administration and then nominated for this top post at the USDA.
Mm-hmm. And the considerable controversy surrounding his nomination, which we've reported on, under criticism for his, I guess, lack of science credentials as the top scientist at the Agriculture Department.
That's right. He has no credentials as a scientist, and yet by statute, that position is supposed to go to someone with a science background, has always been held by someone with a science background, and he was, I think there was wide agreement that he wasn't really qualified for the job.
Okay. But nevertheless, there was nothing until this week stopping him from pursuing that nomination path.
Right.
Mm-hmm. There were other questions about him, too. I don't know if you know, supposed disparaging statements about blacks, women, LGBT.
He's been around for a while. He was a professor at Morningside College in Sioux City, but also a radio talk show host in Sioux City, and that's where he sort of distinguished himself as an ultra-conservative, including the kinds of remarks that you just mentioned.
Mm-hmm. So let's go to this week, the happenings. Sam Clovis writing in a letter to President Trump this week that he does, in his words, not want to be a distraction or a negative influence, citing, quote, relentless assaults on you and your team that seem to be a blood sport. What do we know about what was revealed this week to make Sam Clovis withdraw his name?
Well, the news this week, of course, from the Robert Mueller investigation is that one piece of the news is that a foreign policy advisor in the Trump administration, George Papadopoulos, was not only indicted, but he has pled guilty and he is cooperating with the Mueller investigation. The court documents and other reports indicate that he was attempting to set up arrangements with Russian officials and encouraged the Trump campaign to do so. He and Sam Clovis were linked. Sam Clovis was also on the foreign policy team, and there was indication in the court documents that Sam Clovis encouraged him to travel to Russia and meet with Russian officials. His attorney says that he was only encouraging him to do that as a private citizen. But he's now cooperating with the Mueller. Papadopoulos is now cooperating with the Mueller investigation. Sam Clovis was questioned by the Mueller people, mm-hmm. At least by one report, also appeared before the grand jury. So he may have legal problems ahead of him if the Mueller team continues to look at any role that he played in the Trump campaign trying to connect with the Russians.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we'll see what the future of Sam Clovis is as this Mueller investigation continues to reveal new things almost every week. I don't know. What do we know about who the Trump administration wants to nominate in the place of Sam Clovis, a person with a similar lack of science credentials?
Well, that's a good question. I haven't heard anything about that. Mr. Clovis is apparently still an advisor to the president. The White House declined to comment, by one press report, declined to comment on whether that was the case. But the USDA, in another news report, confirmed that he is still an advisor, mm-hmm. to the Department of Agriculture. So he hasn't lost his job there altogether, apparently.
So, Joyce, any thoughts about, Sam Clovis, if he does sort of more or less leave the Trump administration, if he would come back to Iowa, for instance?
Well, he is a tenured professor at Morningside College, and he's on an unpaid leave there while he serves in the Trump administration. There have been comments from Morningside officials unhappy with some of the comments that that Mr. Clovis has made. So even though he's a tenured professor, it's not 100% sure that he would have his job back if he came back to Iowa.
Iowa Public Radio legislative correspondent Joyce Russell filling us in on some details about Sam Clovis, the former Trump campaign aide, an Iowan, pulling his name from consideration as the USDA's top scientist. Thanks, Joyce.
Thank you, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Still to come a little later in the hour, Iowa's largest truck stop plans to get even bigger. Also a preview of the Gas Feed and Seed Fest that's in Davenport. But first, we heard this week the testimony about the testimony. If you didn't hear any of it on C-SPAN, for instance, we heard news reports of the testimony on Capitol Hill, how Russian trolls got into our Facebook feeds. We learned that, for instance, as many as 126 million Facebook users may have seen content linked to Russian digital active measures. Twitter says their company has uncovered thousands of Russian-linked accounts, tens of thousands of automated bots at work in Twitter. Joining us now with his thoughts on the new revelations, what this might mean for the way we get our news in the future. Michael Bougea is the professor and former director of the Greenlee School of Journalism at Iowa State University in Ames. He's in our Ames studio. Michael, welcome back to the program.
Oh, thank you. It's good to hear your voice. Happy to do this.
Good to hear your voice. You are the author of a book, and we're going to have a good long hour on this program. I want to remind our listeners, November 13th, here on River to River, we'll have you on the entire hour to talk about some of the fascinating things you write about in Interpersonal Divide in the Age of the Machine, your latest book. But, some of the themes we'll talk about today as well, but that coming up on November 13th. Before I get your reaction to this testimony, Michael, I want to have us listen to one of the most worrying and entertaining bits of audio that we pulled. This is Facebook Vice President and General Counsel Colin Stretch being quizzed by Minnesota Senator Al Franken.
How did Facebook, which prides itself on being able to process billions of data points and instantly transform them into personal connections for its user, somehow not make the connection that electoral ads paid for in rubles were coming from Russia? Those are two data points. American political ads and Russian money, rubles. How could you not connect those two dots?
Senator, you mentioned one aspect of the Russian threat that was so visible in 2016, which was the question of account compromise, stealing contents, and disseminating them. And that's a threat our security team was intensely focused on and we think effectively addressed. I think in hindsight, we should have had a broader lens. There were signals we missed, and we are now focused.
People are buying ads on your platform with rubles. They're political ads. You put billions of data points together all the time. That's what I hear that these platforms do. They're the most sophisticated things invented by man ever. Google has all knowledge that man has ever developed. You can't put together rubles with a political ad and go like, those two data points spell out something bad.
Senator, it's a signal we should have been alert to, and in hindsight, it's one we missed.
Okay, yeah.
What else can you say? But okay, okay, yeah. Senator Al Franken there talking with the Facebook General Counsel Colin Stretch. So let me just get your general reaction. First of all, we have 2 or 3 minutes, and we'll go away for a break and come back with you, Michael. But first of all, I don't know how much you were following this, or what if you want to react to that.
Yeah, I can react to any of this stuff. You know, I started my research on this in 1999, and boy, have we come a long way since then.
Right.
Look, you know, if you read the book, you know there's a chapter called "The World Without Why," and you know, technology does two things. It does two things very well. It surveils because it was developed by the military, and it sells because it was adapted by business. With computer, in order to sell a product, you don't need to know why. You need to know how, what, where, when, and to whom, but why is superfluous. So it's very easy for me to tell you why they missed rubles. Algorithms don't make a distinction between dollars and rubles. It's all money to the machine. You need a human being to say, oh, rubles are from Russia, and we should be worried about that. Machines don't think the way humans do. It says they paid, it's in rubles, and what the machine said is, what's the current rate?
So translated into dollars?
It's translated into dollars. I mean, the idea that algorithms are somehow going to find out where a Russian agent is planting in our systems, to me, it doesn't work. You need a human being and a critical mind. And Google, for instance, has thousands of ad raiders. That's why YouTube, you know, didn't have as many hits. I think it was like 18 channels and maybe 300,000 views on all their on Russian agents uploading divisive material. That's because they have thousands of people viewing YouTube. It's a dreary job, but someone has to do it.
But that shows us, does it not, Michael? It is possible to police this.
Oh, sure, it's possible. I mean, Facebook has a value of something like $24 billion. I'd like to see Mark Zuckerberg in front of that judiciary subcommittee rather than the council.
There's a reason they set their lieutenants, because they knew Al Franken was going to be
there. But the interesting thing that the answer, there is an answer to Al Franken's question, and is that machines cannot analyze. They can only tell you how, what, you know, where and when and to whom things happen, but not why. And this is the biggest problem that we have and that we have to face. Perhaps we can go a little bit more into that the next time we speak, but there has to be something done so that Americans understand that they should not harbor the worst suspicions about their fellow citizens, because if they do, they will affirm what the Russians want us to do.
Okay.
We need to be skeptical.
We're going to come back. You stay put there, Michael Bouchier.
Thank
don't
you,
move.
Ben.
We've got a lot to tap you for. When we come back, I want to ask Michael if this is in any way some kind of turning point for the way we view social media. No, it's always been maintained. Oh, we're just a neutral platform. It's merely a conduit. But is it now? Do they have to take responsibility for the content that they distribute? We'll talk about that. Also, the future of journalism broadly, how that ties into it. If we have time, I'm going crazy about this accelerated news cycle we're living in since last year. I don't know if Michael is. We'll ask him about that as well. Michael Bougea of Iowa State's Greenlee School of Journalism, back in just a minute. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Short conversations to finish off the week. We want to finish off a conversation fascinating with Michael Bougea, professor, former director of the Greenlee School of Journalism at Iowa State University. His latest book, Interpersonal Divide in the Age of the Machines. We plan a whole hour with Michael on Monday, November 13th. Please tune in for that. I want to get his take on the testimony this week on Capitol Hill, learning how Russian trolls got into our social media. Let's pick up with what I said on the way out there. Does this, Michael, in your mind, represent a kind of turning point, the 2016 use of social media by the Russians, the meddling, and so forth? And now, as we uncover what it is, will it mark a change in the way we view social media? Is it no longer just this copper wire neutral conduit?
I really don't know. As for me, you know, I've been on this thing for a long time, and every time I try to make predictions, I'm several years ahead, and typically people say that I'm cynical about it. But I'm not cynical about this, and haven't been cynical for a long time. You know, these are the social media aspect of what we do each day. We spend about 11 hours per day. The Americans spend about 11 hours a day looking at a screen. A lot of that is spent on social media. So when it gets to all these fake political ads and posts that divide us, we're going to have to step back and say, how are we going to hold these companies accountable?
Right.
Largely, they are operating without FTC, Truth in Advertising. You know, where's the Federal Trade Commission on this? Where's FTC, Truth in Advertising? I haven't heard anything from the news on that. But above that, there are ways to hold Facebook in particular, but also Twitter, accountable. Let me talk about the danger of Twitter. I mean, you know, people have been kind of chuckling this week when a departing employee at Twitter shut down President Trump's Twitter account for 11 minutes.
Right.
Okay. Now, that person, he or she, had access to that account. Imagine if it wasn't shut down. Imagine if that person said that, in Trump's words, and it wouldn't be Trump, President Trump, it would be this employee saying that there's going to be a military action. Now, think about planting somebody in Twitter over the long haul to do something just like that. There are safety concerns on both ends of this internet.
Wow, that could launch missiles.
Exactly right. And we are not policing these tech companies. We have been enamored of tech companies, and journalism in particular has been enamored of tech companies now for years. So they get we don't pass judgment. We don't hold them accountable. I'd like to hold them accountable. I'd like to see Facebook in particular have an executive at the CEO level that monitors fake news, fake advertisements. I'd like to see subsidy payments to legitimate news that Facebook is stealing from, you know, Iowa Public Radio. They're stealing River to River. They're stealing all that stuff.
Can't you just cast that in a different way and say they're extending our reach? They're making us better known. Okay. I mean, stealing is one way of putting it, sure.
Yeah, but take a look at the impact of that. That's okay, you've really hit on a sore point with me. Because no one has really sat down and figured out the fiscal impact. We believe that more exposure is going to lead to more subscriptions or more viewers or more listeners. There are really no data that support that. So when I see the Des Moines Register, for instance, doing video and spending all this money on multimedia, I want to ask the Des Moines Register, show me the bottom line. And what's happening with this is that we can no longer invest in these legitimate news sources. And what we do is just click on whatever's there. Now, the click business is not that we're the theft, and that's just my being a journalist. But the fact of the matter is if we give content away for free, then we're just going to take any content that comes along. So there's not a healthy skepticism anymore. I don't know about you, Ben, but I have lost Facebook friends by pointing out fake news on their sites.
Right.
And think about that. You're just saying, oh, that's not true, what you just put about President Trump or what you just put about Hillary Clinton. That's not true. Here's a link from Snoops, and you can see that it's not true. And then they unfriend you. What does that say anymore?
You've had that happen.
Oh, yes, several times. Mm. You know, the fact of the matter is that if you take a look at how to hold these social media companies accountable, number one, I think the Senate is going to eventually force them to have ad raters like Google does. That's raters, RATERS, to take a look at the content. I think the Senate
and remove unsuitable content.
Yeah, and remove machines can do only so much in this regard. Facebook said they're going to hire 10,000 employees, but most of those, I imagine, are going to be engineers and artificial intelligence people.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing that we should do is we should start thinking about, in Iowa particularly, and as an Iowa professor, I have been advocating for a required course in media and technology literacy, because the only way really to get at this is to embrace Iowa's foundation in education and think in the long term rather than a technology-motivated short term. In the long term, we've got to be able to tell our students, our young people particularly, you may know how to be a consumer on technology, but let's look at computer programming. Let's look at computer science. Let's take a look at what machines can do and what humans can do. That, I think, is essential in helping solve this problem.
Michael, you're really whetting my appetite for our conversation later this month. But before we go, we've got a minute or two left here. I wanted to get your quick take on this, searching for the answer to our accelerated news cycle. Since last year, of course, we've all lived, whether you're a journalist or not, in this noticeably accelerated news cycle environment. Big things that happened just a few days ago seem old now because we have a fire hose of big news blasts all the time. Is this the way it will be forever?
Well, I have been talking about this since, you know, about 12 years ago, I started to get into cultural acceleration. The computer is asynchronous. It doesn't know time. It thinks time is an emergency. Every email is an emergency. Every tweet is an emergency. That's how computers think, because we've developed our values according to the values of the processor and the ever faster speeds of our servers and things like that. So we've been living on technology time for a long time. And look at me. I'm trying to get so much information to you in so short a time because we have a minute left to do it. But the fact of the matter is our news cycle now is going from one thing to another. So we never understand that why. I want our listeners to think about understanding why things happen. And if you don't know why things happen, you're going to have to invest some time in what you care about so dearly to find out why. Look at a variety of sources. Read some newspapers. Listening to National Public Radio and Iowa Public Radio. Try to get the whole gist of a matter and then have intelligent discussions at the dinner table when the TV is off, when the computer is off, when the cell phone is off, and see if you can start a public affairs debate in your own home and make it civil, make it intelligent, and make it for the good of the country. And I think if we do that, we're going to take our first steps as individuals toward a more civil society.
Okay. Michael Bouche of Iowa State University, author of his latest book, Interpersonal Divide in the Age of the Machine. We'll be talking about that in depth. So many fascinating things in that book. River to River on November 13th, Monday, November 13th. We'll see you back here then, Michael. Thanks for this reaction to this week's news.
Oh, thank you, Ben.
It's the News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, you've seen it. You've driven by it many times, perhaps countless times, perhaps even also stopped there to get gas or any number of other services. The Iowa 80 Truck Stop. It's hailed as the world's largest truck stop. It's getting even bigger. Construction is underway on a $10 million expansion and remodeling project. This is at the Walcott Truck Stop. It's owned by the Iowa 80 Group. Mike Hutchison is general manager of the I-80 Truck Stop. He joins us now. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
You have been working at the truck stop since you were 14.
Yes.
And that's going on pretty much 40 years now, right?
Yes.
Wow. Okay. I want to talk about that in a minute. But first of all, why do you need this expansion?
To expand our convenience store, our food court areas, you know, we expanded our gas islands last year to just take care of our customers faster and much smoother.
Mm-hmm. How many customers filling up do you get every day, do you know?
We have about 5,000 people a day come through the truck stop itself.
Mm-hmm. What other services? Can you list off a few that you have in the largest truck stop there?
Oh, we've got multiple. We've got our truck wash, our truck service center, our fuel center, 8 fast foods and our full-service restaurant. And then we've got a dentist office, a chiropractor office, a barber shop, and a movie theater for truck drivers and the public.
A movie theater for truck drivers? Is that any different than the ones that most of us know?
It's free, and most of the time, you know, it's normal operation hours till about 1 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a place for drivers to come and relax and idle down at night and get ready for the road the next day.
You have a museum as well. What's that about?
Yes, we've had our museum for about 10 years, 14 years. It's got the history of over 100 years of trucks in there, from electric trucks to chain drive trucks. And, our Coca-Cola truck is one of our newer remodels.
Mm-hmm. You've been at this truck stop working there for nearly 40 years. What are the changes you've noticed in perhaps trucking culture?
Oh, considerably differences in when I started. I mean, when I started, you know, drivers, there was a lot more owner-operators back then. And, you know, a driver that also drove a truck, you know, they did a lot more work hands-on. And like the rest of the industry and automotive, you know, back then you had to do a lot more work on your cars.
You mean actually get under the hood?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. And that was back when you started in the late 1970s?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And your first job back then?
I worked at the truck wash, washing trucks.
You washed trucks, and you worked your way up to where you are now general manager of the I-80 truck stop. So you've had a number of jobs there. What was your favorite job, or perhaps it's the current job? being the top dog is not a bad job.
I really liked the technical and fixing things, but I also ran the wrecker for almost 10 years, and I enjoyed running a wrecker because I enjoyed driving a truck.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How many people work there regularly?
We've got about over 300 people on the complex.
Mm. Going back to trucking culture, you know, when I was growing up, a kid like you in the 70s, CB culture, Citizen Band Radio, was all the rage. We loved trucking. There was that song. I can't remember it now. Perhaps you can. But anyway, truckers still use CBs, or has the internet done away with that?
Oh, no. The drivers still use CBs. That's still a good form of communications. You know, the cell phones have really drastically changed that, mm-hmm. but a driver still uses the CB.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad I have you on the line, Mike, because I wanted to ask you about this. When we drive by, and I think I'm quoting this correctly, on one of your signs, very large, the world's largest truck stop on I-80. What does that mean? Is that the largest truck stop in the world or the largest truck stop on I-80?
It was never intent to be the world's largest truck stop, but we've grown into that by making sure whatever we've expanded and takes care of that need, like the fuel center having 15 lanes of fuel pumps and not 8, and, you know, 24 showers and 7 bays for service trucks. And, you know, and everything has been, if we're going to build it, it's built to take care of our customers. And
mm-hmm. But do you actually look at, like, you know, the tallest skyscraper in the world? They measure it by stories, and people keep track of these things. Do people really keep track of if your truck stop is the largest in the world, or is it kind of just out there as a descriptor, not the absolute?
As the offerings for a truck driver, we probably have the most offerings for a truck stop.
Okay. Mike Hutchison, general manager of the I-80 truck stop, which is now having a $10 million expansion, the biggest truck stop, largest truck stop in the world on I-80, becoming even bigger. Mike, thanks for telling us a little bit about the history of your truck stop and about this new expansion.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Gas Seed and Feed Fest in Davenport. I think it's next weekend. Sean Moeller is with us. Is it next weekend or this weekend, Sean?
It's next weekend, Ben.
All right, good. Thanks for joining us. Sean Moeller, founder of Moeller Nights, a concert series in the Quad Cities. Another weekend full of music booked for next weekend. The second Gas Feed and Seed Festival, November 9th through the 11th in Davenport. We're going to hear some of the artists here, Sean. How would you describe the music at this festival as an umbrella term?
You know, I think most of the music that I like trying to program for this thing is just, a lot of them are just my favorite bands at the moment. And so I hear somebody that I love and I just immediately reach out to them and say, hey, can you come to Davenport? And I'm lucky enough to talk a bunch of those. I think it's called hoodwinking, maybe. But I get them to come to Davenport and play for everybody here. And I think it's just kind of like it's a setup for kind of the coming year for me, as far as like seeing who everybody gravitates to, who everybody loves, and then bring them back multiple times. I mean, the idea of the festival is this kind of nurturing festival where I like bringing people that maybe other people don't know about and seeing what kind of hits for people and then trying to keep growing them in the region. And it's just a lot of fun. You know, there's a lot of names that people don't know. There's some names that people do know, and we just kind of have a good time with it.
Okay, Sean, let's fire through, give a little taste of some of the artists you'll be having in the Quad Cities. Lolo, now this is a veteran of the Codfish Hollow venue. We want to hear a little bit of I Don't Want to Have to Lie, Lolo's song there. Tell us a little bit about Lolo before we start it.
Yeah, she's a Tennessee-based artist, and you know, a little bit of like everything. Her people have kind of always branded her as kind of a Janis Joplin sort of throwback, and she's just a really soulful, amazing person. And I mean, it's something that should be on the radio. And I don't know, we fell in love with her a few years ago, and kind of can't bring her back enough. Everybody loves her, and she's an amazing performer.
Let's hear a little bit of Lolo. I Don't Want to Have to Lie. Wow, Adele, are you listening? Lolo is in Iowa. What a singer! Wow.
She's incredible. Yeah, I could see her every night.
Sarah Jaffe is another artist you have. Tell us about her before we hear a bit of her her tunes.
Yeah, so she's from Texas, and she's been around a little while. She's kind of gone through a little bit of a transformation with her next album. I believe what we're going to hear is an older song. But she's gotten a little more poppy and a little more electronic. And so it's going to be interesting to see kind of the mix of those two in her set next week.
Okay, Sarah Jaffe with Clementine. Jaffe, Clementine there, male performer you'll be having, Corey Chisel. Now, my producer, Lindsay, I haven't heard Corey before, but Lindsay says that he's so fun because he's so interactive with the audience, Sean.
Yeah, his banter is really great. I mean, this guy is, he's kind of one of the most unsung sort of superstars, I think, in America. He's become a good friend, and he gets involved with the Best Fest a lot, which are kind of the tribute festivals for like Tom Petty and things like that. And he's kind of like one of those guys that everybody wants to be around. All musicians respect him, and he's one of the most soulful guys I've ever met. And you know, as a performer, he pulls you real close.
Okay, let's hear a little bit of Corey Chisel, Songbird.
Rock. I've had a lifespan chasing what my heart couldn't name. Love, you fan that flame. Oh, my dear sister, you're the fire in the field.
Okay, I wish we had more time to hear Corey Chisel there. We're going to go out here, Sean, with a little bit of Okie Dokie, another one of the artists, Wavy Gravy, we're going to hear on the way out. But remind our listeners how they can find out more about the Gas Festival happening November 9th through the 11th in Davenport.
Yeah, so the lineup and tickets are all available on Moeller Nights, MoellerNights.com. And everything's there. You can listen to everybody, see photos of everybody, and check everything out before you buy. But it's going to be a fun weekend.
Okay. Thanks for telling us a little bit about it, Sean Moeller. And we'll go out with Okie Dokie. They'll be there. This is Wavy Gravy. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Help today also from Robbie Broad and Sean McClain. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Stay wavy gravy. Thanks for joining us.